Elaine Lundquist. So tune if you can, and have a great, great week, and the Lord bless you all.
Listening to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM, K282 BH Philomath on 104.3 FM, and K220 HR Hood River on 91.9 FM.
Hello and welcome to Pathways, where you are invited to join me for a visit with leaders in personal development in cultural evolution. This is your host, Paul O'Brien. Okay, today we've got a fantastic show, and it's about addictions and about recovery. And, you know, without healthy coping mechanisms, trauma and stress can settle in the body and even open the door to addiction. And God knows we've had a lot of trauma and stress lately. Recovering from addiction means finding ways to enter a healing process that allows us to rediscover ourselves in new ways with tools that are supportive and life-enhancing instead of self-defeating and destructive. Our guest on Pathways today is Stephen Washington, author of the new book, Recovering You, Soul Care and Mindful Movement for Overcoming Addiction. As a former professional dancer who performed on Broadway in Disney's The Lion King, Stephen's love of movement inspired him to become the highly acclaimed Qigong and Pilates teacher that he is today. Stephen lives a joyful life of recovery and is passionate about helping others as they navigate towards health and happiness. Hello, Stephen, and welcome to the Pathway Show.
Hello, Paul. Thank you so much for having me. It's lovely to be here.
All right, let's start out by asking you, how did you come to write this book?
Well, actually, this book was originally an online course that I created and it had a completely different name. The course was called Release, Recover, and Renew. And I created that course, I think, in 2018. And as I was creating that course and putting it out there into the world, part of me knew that that was just going to be the beginning of the conversation I was going to have with other people around the topic of addiction and just the beginning of the sharing of the tools that I have used and gathered over the last 20 years of recovery. So this book came about, I started writing it about 2 years after that, after Georgia, from New World Library approached me about writing a book. And I just thought that this topic would be very special and much needed. Like you said at the beginning, we could all use self-care tools because at the heart of the book, it's about self-care and stress management. And I honestly believe that everyone is recovering from something. I think of the word recovery as transformation, change, and we're always going through some sort of transformation or change. So I think that makes it applicable to everyone. But being a person who has addiction in my past, this, I know that the practices within this book are really effective for those of us who deal with addictions of any kind.
Okay, so let's talk about this word. It's a big word, addiction. It's thrown around a lot these days. What does it mean? I mean, how do you define, what is an addiction? Can I be addicted to approval? Can I be addicted to attention? You know, or is it a, you know, I know it's more than substances. There's habits. You know, how would you define addiction? Because I agree with you. I think that everybody is dealing with something of an addictive nature. And it kind of is one of the, it's one way to interpret Buddhism, which says that suffering is caused by attachment that causes that we can't get away from. So how would you define addiction?
That's a really great question. For me, addiction means a attachment, a connection to a particular behavior that despite negative consequences, we continue to repeat over and over and over again, and perhaps expecting different results.
Okay. And then your book's subtitle is very interesting: Soul Care and Mindful Movement for Overcoming Addiction. So what do you mean by soul care, and why is it so important?
Well, I believe that soul care is something that is important for each and every one of us. And whenever we do anything that takes care of our body, our mind, and our spirit, we are also tending to the soul. Anything that we do for our bodies physically, just daily self-care, affects our soul, that deepest part of ourself. It also affects our emotions, another deep part of ourselves. I look at soul care as something that is connected to those three parts of ourselves, because none of those parts, the soul, the body, the emotions, can be separated. And the body is the foundation for everything else. And so anything that we do that takes care of the body also impacts the deeper layers of ourselves, really our essence.
Okay, so soul is kind of a deep definition of our self, of our fundamental self. Okay. Now, you write, in my observation of myself and others in recovery over the years, I've seen a correlation between addiction and high sensitivity. And I found that to be a very interesting statement. Can you elaborate, please?
Absolutely. Well, I consider myself to be a very sensitive person. I grew up in a very chaotic environment, and that chaotic environment was very difficult for someone like myself who was very sensitive. And I think one of the things that makes us very sensitive is trauma. And that's another word that's being talked about a lot in our culture. And what we're starting to understand is that there are many ways that we experience trauma. Trauma is not just about going off to war and the impacts of war, or being a victim of a violent crime or anything like that. There's so many other things that one can experience that would fall into the category of trauma. And when we are dealing with trauma and trauma impacting the body without any way of managing it or addressing it, it makes our system very overly sensitive. And so I know in my circumstance, I am a person who was very sensitive, and also my nervous system was very oversensitized because of trauma in my life. And I think all of that really primed me for looking outside of myself for relief.
Right. And if you don't mind me asking, what kind of trauma did you grow up with?
Well, there was a lot of addiction in my family. So alcohol and drugs and cigarettes, a lot of anger, a lot of high emotion, Now, mind you, I'm African American, and there's a certain level of trauma that is inherent in our community because of the history of this country.
Right.
And so my parents really transmitted a lot of their trauma that they experienced in their formative years, coming from the South, moving to the North. And then my own experiences around that. I'm also a member of the LGBT community. And so growing up with this knowledge about myself was quite challenging when living in a world that doesn't necessarily support or recognize or value people of the LGBTQ community. And so those are just a few things that I experienced growing up that were quite traumatic for me.
Okay. Now, I'm wondering, in your life, how would you say addiction has actually served a purpose?
Well, I think for a long time, my use of alcohol and drugs and cigarettes and even food helped me to survive. They helped me to survive because what I was looking for, without really even knowing it, was a way to self-soothe.
Right.
And to self-regulate. I didn't know that's what I was doing, but that's clearly what I was doing. And those things helped me. And for a long time, they worked. They worked really well until they didn't work anymore, until there were consequences, and the consequences became greater and greater over time.
Right. You know, you say in your book, and I quote, "The details differ, but we all want freedom from the things that keep us feeling separate from ourselves and from others. That's the first level of freedom we seek, connection, companionship, and love. Then there's the freedom we seek within our own minds, from patterns of thinking, perceiving, behaving, and interacting that leave us feeling like hamsters on a wheel. Round and round we go, getting nowhere until we're ready to step off and start the life that is patiently and faithfully waiting for us." Oh, that's just beautiful. Very,
thank you.
Very profound about our desire for freedom and the and how addictions keep us stuck on some hamster wheel.
Trapped.
Yeah.
Trapped when you feel like you have very few options.
Now, your book is so practical. It's such a healing manual for people. And like you said, I think it applies to everybody. You know, it's sort of like we've all are dealing with ways that we're stuck or things, coping mechanisms that we compulsively turn to. And you point to some self-care strategies or techniques such as, and three in particular, deep breathing, self-massage, and meditation. And you point to these as essential practices for daily wellness. How have you incorporated these practices into your life?
That's a really good question. Thank you for asking that, Paul. Well, I found these practices over time. A lot of these practices came into my life about 10 years into recovery. And it came at a time when I was very desperate for tools to help me live life on life's terms after 10 years of sobriety, after my life had gotten so big. And self-massage, I went to massage school, and that was probably one of the greatest gifts that was ever given to me. And I learned there that self-massage is a wonderful way to connect with oneself. It's one of the greatest gifts that we can give to ourselves, probably one of the most loving and compassionate gifts that we can give to ourselves. And so some sort of self-massage is part of my self-care routine just about every day. I always end the day by massaging my feet. I teach people how to massage different parts of their body in the book. And I think the feet are so incredible. They support us in and out of every single day. And they don't tend to get a lot of good treatment and respect. So I think it's important to do that. And that's an important part of my practice. And I start off my day by just connecting to my breath. I take a few deep breaths when I wake up, and I just reflect on what my intention is for the day. I usually start my day off with a little bit of prayer. and a few moments of silence and some deep breathing. That's very helpful for me. And I always end my day with a bit of meditation in bed and a little bit of reading. Those are the things that I do that are kind of like bookmarks throughout my day. And then I fill in other things depending upon what I need during the day. It might be a 12-step recovery meeting. It might be spending time out in nature. It might be meeting with a friend, connecting with another person. Because I think one of the things that I really try to stress in this book is community and how important community and connection is in relationships, and how that is very vital to successful recovery. But I think it's also vital to good mental health.
Yeah,
those are the ways. Mm-hmm.
Thank you. You talk about how addiction breeds isolation and how important community is in the recovery process. That seems pretty key to me. And I imagine there's a lot of people who are suffering from an addiction of some sort. Maybe they don't even define it that way. And they find themselves isolating themselves and becoming more lonely and alienated from everybody, including themselves. And when you're talking about community, are you like focused on 12-step meetings, or is it a broader definition?
It's broader than that. I use 12-step recovery as part of my community because that's what's worked for me. But there are also other groups that aren't 12-step related that can provide community. Some people find community in their spiritual life and their spiritual centers. I think that's important too. Friends and family are important as well. Just some place where we can get the support that we need, where we can be around people who understand us, that won't judge us, that will really are looking for and looking out for our well-being and best interests. I think that that's important. And just not keeping your suffering or your difficulties to yourself. A problem shared is a problem halved. I think that's really important. And one of the things that we often tend to do, especially when you're dealing with addiction, is we try to just keep things to ourselves. And that's in part because of fear and because of shame. We may be doing things in our lives that we feel shameful about, or we may have had experiences where we feel shameful about them. And that keeps us silent. And that keeps us, what I think, sick as well. So it's important to really try to build a community. I think addiction is so much about isolation, and recovery is so much about community and having social support.
You talk about shame, and you mentioned in the book what a big part shame is in addiction. And I'm wondering, how can we loosen its grip on our lives?
It's a good question. I always love to refer back to something that sociologist Brené Brown has said about shame, that shame needs three things to survive: silence, secrecy, and judgment. And when we share our shame with someone who is trusted, someone who has earned the right to hear us speak about our shame, you don't want to just talk about those things with just anyone. Not everyone has earned the right to hear such a deep, intimate part of yourself. But it's important to find someone who can listen to you, so you're not keeping it silent, you're not keeping it a secret, because things fester and grow in the dark. And then also to be able to share it with someone who we know won't judge us. Wow. And it's that non-judgment from that other person that is in some ways an invitation, or it gives us permission to judge ourselves less harshly and to be self-compassionate to ourselves, to help us to work through shame. Shame is such a big topic, and I always suggest that if people are really suffering greatly from the shame that they're holding, that they work with someone who is a professional, a psychotherapist, a counselor, to help them to unpack and pick apart shame.
So it's kind of a mistake to expose your shame to someone who's not prepared to accept it, or who's not empathetic, or who's judge liable to judge you for it. You know, I think that's a pitfall for a lot of us. I know I've made that mistake many times in my life.
Not everyone is able to hold our shame.
Right.
Like holding space for someone. Not everyone is able to do that.
Right. So how do you tell if somebody is able to, or that they're trustworthy enough to do that for you?
Well, I think that what's important is to pay attention to the history that you have with that person and just notice whether or not this person has been able to support you in the small things, but also in the larger things. And that they really have an interest in you, not just when you're doing well, but also when you're not doing well. I think that's really important. And listening to your intuition. I talk about intuition and tapping into that part of ourselves. And for some people, it's challenging to trust their intuition because they think that what they tell themselves isn't necessarily worth following, or is good advice or good direction or guidance. But I feel as though each and every one of us has intuition, has a level of intuition and inner wisdom. And we've just gotten into a habit of not paying attention to that, to doubt, for doubting ourselves and not really allowing that part of ourselves to have a voice and to listen to what it offers. So I think that if we listen to that and tap into it, we'll be able to decipher, determine who to trust in terms of who to bring our shame to and who not to. And sometimes there'll be mistakes. We might share something with someone and they're not really able to hold what we bring to them. And we can consider that as a lesson learned. But I feel as though we should never stop trying, because it's that connection is so important in recovery. We all need connection. People need people.
Right. Yeah, well, like you say, one of the markers of shame is secrecy. And so I could imagine somebody feeling like, well, I don't want to hide. I don't want to pretend. And so I'm going to be super open. And this kind of brings up the possibility that a person can be too open with the wrong people. Which
yeah.
is not something I you ever read about, but it occurs to me that that's something to be careful about.
Of course, and that, I think that's one of those lessons that we learn in life. We learn in adulthood. We learn how to have relationships with one another, and hopefully we're learning how to have healthy relationships with one another and have boundaries.
Now, you bring up the fact that stress itself can trigger us, and that being triggered can lead to panic or worry. And so I want to ask you about triggers, and you have a concept in the book that I had never seen before, which is the trigger plan and why it's important to have one. Can you explain that?
Well, triggers is, it's just something that each and every one of us has. We can often feel triggered by stressful events. And as someone in recovery dealing with addiction, it's really important to have a sense of what your triggers are, because they are going to happen at some point in your life in recovery. And it's important that you have a plan of action when you feel triggered. And people feel triggered in different ways. Like some people feel triggered to relapse when things are going well in their life. Some people feel triggered to relapse when things are bad. Some people feel triggered by certain people in their life, or some people feel triggered when it's payday and they suddenly have extra money in their pocket and time, and that could lead them to use. Some people, it's a location. And I say all these things because those are things that were very much a trigger for me in early recovery. There were certain people that I could not allow myself to be around because it was just too triggering for me to be with them, because it would remind me of my active using. Or certain neighborhoods I couldn't be in, I had to avoid them because it was just too triggering, because I spent time in that bar and that bar, and and it was just too much for me. So I had to think of ways to avoid or to take care of myself. And some of the things that I did was, if I knew I was going to enter in a difficult situation, or even if I didn't, I would be prepared enough by like having a list of people that I could call when I'm feeling triggered. And I would call those people, and I'd have several, because you're not always going to get someone on the phone. So you want to have someone else to call or someone else to reach out to. And just the action of making that phone call or sending that text, having that conversation, can walk you through those first few moments of feeling triggered to bring yourself back down to earth, and help you to self-soothe and self-regulate so that you don't have to act out in a harmful way. That's one of the things I would do. And also, when it came to neighborhoods that were triggering for me, I would just find alternative routes to get to wherever I was going, so right, I wouldn't pass by those places. Things like that are really important to think about, to consider, and to have in place so that you're not caught completely off guard, but also so that you don't live your life constantly looking for that. You know, you want to be able to live with a sense of freedom, like we talked about earlier.
Right, right. Well, we've only got about a minute left, and there's so much to talk about. There's so much in this book, you know, like you talk about the gratitude break, taking a gratitude break. You talk about faith, the role of a higher power, or whatever you want to call it, and all the different things that people can call it. It's just so much here. But I want to just kind of close our conversation today by just giving you permission. Do you have any suggestions for our listeners about how to celebrate the holiday season without using?
Oh, that's such a beautiful question. I was just talking about this in my monthly YouTube video. Well, if you're someone who is trying to stay sober through the holiday season, because it tends to be very triggering for a lot of us, it's important to surround yourself with people who are like-minded and trying to stay sober or to do life-enhancing things. So stick close, keep them close. Have a bunch of numbers that you can call people if you feel like you need some extra support. It's okay to say no. You know, there are a lot of holiday parties that are happening right now and gatherings. And if you don't feel well within yourself, it's okay to say no. That's really important. And the word no is a complete sentence.
You know.
And then yeah.
Go ahead. Lastly.
And then lastly, whenever I'm in a party, I always make sure I have a non-alcoholic drink in my hand, because people who drink alcohol sometimes feel uncomfortable if they're talking to someone who doesn't have a drink in their hand. So that's what I do.
Okay.
to navigate things like that.
Well, Stephen, there's so much more we could explore, and we've run out of time. I want to make sure to tell our listeners about your website, which is www.stephenwashingtonexperience.com. All one word, stephenwashingtonexperience.com. And there they can find all kinds of information about your book and other works that you have put forth. And I want to say, for those who may have tuned in to Pathways late today, this is your host, Paul O'Brien, author of Intuitive Intelligence, a book that shares the theme of Pathways, which is personal and cultural evolution. Now, don't worry, you can play and or share this interview whenever you want via the internet or as a free podcast, and I'll tell you how in a minute. Today, we've been visiting with Stephen Washington, author of Recovering You, Soul Care and Mindful Movement for Overcoming Addiction. I want to say thank you to all of our listeners for tuning into Pathways, which is broadcast and streamed on the internet at www.kboo.fm, produced every Sunday morning by Donald Altman or myself at 8:30 USA Pacific Time. Podcasts of today's show, which you can listen to and forward to others, are available for free at divination.com. spelled DIVINATION.com, as well as via iTunes, my YouTube channel, and other free podcast servers. This is Paul O'Brien reminding you to tell your friends about Pathways Radio and podcasts. And thanks again to Stephen Washington and all you listeners for tuning in and being a part of the Pathways conversation.
This is Roxanne Dunbar Ortiz, and this is KBOO Portland.
KBOO Community Radio holds open meetings concerning the operations and programming of KBOO in accordance with requirements of the Communications Act of 1934 and certification requirements.